Well, Hinduism is perhaps the oldest and most complex religion in the world. Most of the religions we've been looking at have started no later than the 5th century B.C. Hinduism we can trace back to the 3rd millennium B.C., 2,500 to 3,000 years before even Buddhism. Hinduism is perhaps the most tolerant of all the religions. Hinduism views the truth that's the seed of every religion as being the same. Hinduism teaches that the doctrines in each religion may be different because the truth is lived out in different human circumstances. But basically, all religions lead to the same reality. There is no identifiable founder for Hinduism. And when one identifies himself as a Hindu, the possibilities of his religious views are endless. He could be a polytheist, or a monotheist, or a pantheist, or an agnostic, or even an atheist. You might remember that the Beatle George Harrison went to India and there embraced Hinduism as a religion. The Beatles had a hit single back in 1969 called My Sweet Lord. And in that song, George Harrison sang the Hare Krishna mantra in the background vocals. Now, many a discerning Christian parents thought that that was a Christian song, singing about My Sweet Lord. Mine did. But it was very much not a Christian song. It was a Hindu song. And Hinduism has many converts like George Harrison. A lot of people have investigated Hinduism. People that are on a spiritual quest, they'll read different things. They'll read the Quran, they'll read the Bible, they'll read the Bhagavad Gita and make a decision. And many people have embraced Hinduism that way. But Hinduism has never been a missionary religion. They don't have any missionaries. They don't try to get out and try to convert you to their religion. In fact, the word Hindu is not a religious word at all. It's derived from the Sanskrit name given to the major river in the Indus Valley in northwest India. In Sanskrit, it's the Sindhu. And the people that lived beyond this river were called Hindus by the ancient Greeks. When the Muslims invaded that area in the 7th and 8th century, they referred to the people that were there as Hindustanis, to separate them from the Arab Muslims that came in there. And then when the British took over India, they lumped all the local religions under one rubric and just called them Hinduism. So that's how we come to be called, all the belief systems in India, Hinduism. The known history begins with the entrance into India of a people called the Aryans. The Aryan conquerors during the 2nd millennial B.C. And the religion that these Aryans brought with them mingled with the indigenous religion in India, and the result was the Hindu religion and culture that became classical Hinduism. The pre-Aryan religion in India was a polytheistic religion. They worshipped fertility gods. Archaeologists have discovered statues of gods and goddesses that they worshipped, some of them in the lotus position that became a part of the Hinduism and Buddhism. But the word Aryan itself was given a bad light by Adolf Hitler. Back in the 1800s, a philosopher by the name of Hegel wrote a philosophy of history, and in it he divided the world up into three different areas and three different intellects, with sub-Saharan black Africa at the bottom, Asia in the middle, and the Europeans at the top. 100 years later, Adolf Hitler read this book, and he believed it, and he got the idea that the Europeans, and specifically the Germans, were the super race, and he adopted the name Aryans for them, and he turned north to get his description of them. He described them, the super race, as being tall, broad, blonde, blue-eyed, fair-skinned. But obviously, he looked the wrong direction. Now, the Aryans were really south, much darker skinned. This, of course, has no anthropological or historical benefit or basis to it. It was just a figment of Hitler's imagination. The term Aryan is a Sanskrit word that means the noble ones, and it was applied to these groups of migrants who moved into the Indus Valley in the second millennial BC from the region of Persia. The kinsmen of these migrants who did not go into India stayed in the Middle East, and they became what was known as the Persian Empire, which ruled the Middle East from the 4th to 6th centuries BC. Now, they're the ones that took Israel captive to Babylon and destroyed the temple in 586 BC. And when the modern Persians were seeking a name for the nation, their nation, they chose the word Iran, which means land of the Aryans. The Aryan society began to develop in India into three different categories. They had their priestly caste, or they came to be called caste. The priests were the highest. Then they had their rulers and their warriors. Then they had their merchants and craftsmen. Everybody else consisted of the Indians that were in India when they got there, became the lowest classification. That they were not considered full members of society, and they served as slaves and servants to the Aryans. And these divisions were maintained in Indian society for centuries. They eventually were subdivided into many other groups, to where now you have four basic caste categories, but within each one you have a lot of different categories. Now, the Aryans brought with them a polytheistic religion. They worshipped various gods, mostly personifications of natural events like storms and sun and moon, those kind of things. And the chief manner of worship for the Aryans was sacrifice. And their one major sacrifice that was only performed by rulers and very wealthy people was called the horse sacrifice. And a horse sacrifice, a young horse was selected, a male horse. He was allowed to roam the countryside free, uninhibited for 1 year. If the horse happened to roam into some territory that was not owned by the ruler that owned the horse, then at the end of the year, that ruler could claim that territory. And at the end of the year, the horse was gathered back in, taken back to the ruler, and then the real ritual ceremony started. It began with the sacrifice of many, many animals, hundreds, even up to 1,000 different animals, some as big as elephants to the smallest animals that the ruler had. And after these animals were sacrificed, then the horse was strangled. After the horse was strangled, the wives of the rulers would perform some kind of fertility rites with this dead horse. Then the horse was cut up and eaten by the ruler's family. And the last horse sacrifice was done in Egypt less than 100 years ago. So that's the kind of religion that the Aryans brought into India. Now let's look at the scriptures that they have. The Vedas. Veda means wisdom or knowledge. It's a collection of four basic books of sacred hymns, prayers, and rituals. And these date from around 1400 BC. And they're considered the most sacred of all the Hindu literature. The Upanishads are the fourth section of each book in the Vedas. And these are believed to have been added much later, maybe around 500 BC. And they mark a definite change in the content. The Upanishads have some magic formulas and rituals and a lot of religious kind of ceremonies. The Upanishads have more of a philosophical framework. And most of Hindu philosophy is based on the Upanishads. Then the Bhagavad Gita was written around the 1st century A.D. That means the song of God. And it's sometimes called the Bible of Hinduism because of its popularity. It's the best known and most read of all the Indian literature. And in essence, the message of the Upanishads and Hindu philosophy is in this Bhagavad Gita. It's considered a guide of how to live the Hindu life. And the story is just as an epic poem, is what it is. And the story revolves around a character named Arjuna and his encounter with Lord Vishnu and then Lord Krishna, one of the gods. The significance of this story has to do with the Hindu belief and endorsement of devotion to a particular god as a means of salvation. The Bhagavad Gita story ends with Arjuna going into battle against his own relatives in obedience to Lord Krishna. The teaching is that to do your duty is painful sometimes, but that's what you have to do if you're devoted to a god. Now, there's one that's not on your list, your handout list here, that I need to add to it. It's called the Code of Manu, M-A-N-U. And it dates from around 100 to 300 A.D. It has historical value for what life was like in the classical era of Hindu history. The roots of many social and religious traditions that characterize Hinduism today is found there. In the Code of Manu, the caste divisions in society are presented as being divinely inspired. And the first three castes are called the twice-born caste. The lowest caste is called the once-born. Twice-born because, obviously, they have been through life one time and have been reborn into a higher caste. So they have at least gone through one cycle of reincarnation. Each caste has certain specific duties called dharma that must be obeyed. So each caste has its own rules, and they must be obeyed or you become an outcast. Okay, the caste system. The caste system is a unique feature in Hindu religion. According to Hindu literature, the origin of the caste system was in Brahma, the god, creator god Brahma, who created Manu. Manu was the first man. And from Manu, four different types of people were created. From Manu's head, the priests were created. From his arms, the craftsmen, the workers, the rulers, the warriors and the rulers were created from his arms. The craftsmen were created from his thighs. And, of course, the lowest class was created from his feet. The upper caste is the spiritual leaders. They're the priestly caste. They're called the Brahmin. If you look at your vocabulary list here, we have Brahma, Brahman, and Brahmins. They're a little confusing, but Brahma is the creator god. Brahman is the absolute, the cosmic force, the consciousness of the universe, and Brahmins are the highest class that were originally the priest. Now they consider some other high political rulers to be of that caste, but basically it's the priestly caste. And the lowest caste, their duty is to serve the upper caste, laborers and servants. They're excluded from many of the religious rituals and are not allowed to study the Vedas. The caste system became more complicated as time went on, with literally thousands of subcastes coming into existence. And today, the caste system is still an integral part of the social order of India, even though the government has outlawed it. You're supposed to marry someone within your own caste. If you're a woman, you're allowed to marry into a higher caste. But if a man marries a woman from a lower caste, he's allowed to ask for more dowry. In other words, the woman's parents have to pay more money for her to marry out of her caste if she goes upward. Let me read you something written by a Swami Swami is a Hindu religious teacher that talks about the rationale for the caste system in Hinduism. He writes, "Caste is a natural order. I can perform one duty in social life and you another. You can govern a country. I can mend a pair of old shoes. But there's no reason why you are greater than I. For can you mend my shoes? Can I govern the country? I'm clever in mending shoes. You're clever in reading the Vedas. But there's no reason why you should trample on my head. Caste is good. That is the only natural way of solving life. Men must form themselves into groups. You cannot get rid of that. Wherever you go, there will be caste. But that does not mean there should be these privileges, one caste over another. That should be knocked in the head. I tell you, if you teach Vedas to the fisherman, he will say, I'm as good as you. I'm a fisherman. You're a philosopher. But I have the same God in me that you have in you. And that is what we want. No privileges for anyone, equal chances for all. Let everyone be taught that the divine is within, and everyone will work out his own salvation." So that's what they believe about the caste system, that it's just part of the natural order of things. And you don't go against it, you go with it and work within it. I heard on BBC Radio 4 last month a report that said that a caste of cow herders in India had requested to be downgraded to a lower caste so that their children could take advantage of some affirmative action programs for the lower caste children, which would give them equal access to colleges and universities. Now, what happened to the system of karma? You know, if you want to be downcast, so you can take advantage of government programs. That just shows how, in all of these religions that we've been looking at, in today's world, most of them are just not livable if you stick to what they believe. Now, let's look at some of the basic beliefs of what Hinduism believes. Now, the law of karma decides whether you will be reborn into a higher caste or a lower caste. Escape from the cycle of reincarnation, it's called moksha, it's on your vocabulary list. It's possible by reaching nirvana. The goal of Hinduism is to end the cycle of reincarnation and reach nirvana. Now, this is different from the Buddhist concept of nirvana, which is extinction. Nirvana in Hinduism is oneness with Brahman, the consciousness of the universe seen as ultimate God. Hindus believe that all living things are Brahman or God. Enlightenment is attained by becoming tuned in to the Brahman within you. Atman, the self-consciousness, the divine soul in every creature, is Brahman, is their goal. I think an example I've used before is in Buddhism. Remember, their nirvana is one thing. Hinduism, their nirvana is another thing. In Hinduism, the goal is to become a drop in the bucket of universal consciousness. When you get in the bucket, you're just a part of everything else that's in the bucket. But in Hinduism, when you get in the bucket's empty. Buddhism, when you get in the bucket, the bucket's empty. They believe that nirvana is just extinction. You totally cease existing. So that's the big difference there. And I need to touch just a moment on how Buddhism separated from Hinduism. You remember when we were talking about Buddhism, Buddha was a Hindu. He was born in India, North India. He was a thinking man. There were certain things about the Hindu religion he did not accept. He did not believe that you needed priests to lead you in your religious quest. If you remember Buddhism, it's very much a do-it-yourself kind of religion. You have to work it out yourself. He did not believe the Vedas were good religious material. He rejected those. So he started his own path to enlightenment, claimed to have gotten it, got his followers, and he started the Hindu religion, the Buddhist religion, about 400 or 500 BC. And it stayed pretty much in North India. Buddhism never did make an effect on the rest of India. Buddhism sent its missionaries to China and Japan in the first century AD. And when the Muslims came into North India in the 7th century, they pretty much wiped out Buddhism. They destroyed all the temples, and the Buddhists either had a choice of becoming Muslims or being killed. That pretty much wiped out all the vestiges of Buddhism in India. And Buddhism now is just pretty much considered to be a Far Eastern kind of religion. Salvation for the Hindu can be achieved in one of four ways. There's the way of works, which consists of doing your religious duty, carrying out prescribed ceremonies, duties, and religious rites. Each religious duty you do adds to your karma merits. It's possible to be reborn even as a Brahmin, be reborn into the priestly caste if you do your religious duties often enough and good enough. That's the way of works. Another way of salvation is the way of knowledge. And the premise behind this is that the cause of human suffering is ignorance. This mental error concerning our own nature is at the root of mankind's problems. The error in man's thinking is this. Man sees himself as a separate and a real entity apart from everything else in the universe. And the truth of the matter is that the only reality is Brahman. There is no other. Therefore, man, rather than seeing himself as a self-entity separate from that, needs to see himself as a part of everything else, a part of the whole. And once you gain that knowledge, then you will reach nirvana. Selfhood is an illusion. As long as man continues seeing himself as a separate reality, he will be chained to the wheel of birth, death, and rebirth. And he must be saved from this wrong belief by proper understanding that he has no independent self. The way of knowledge doesn't appeal to the masses of the people. It's only for the intellectuals who are willing to go through all the prescribed steps and to believe hard enough. A third way of salvation in Buddhism is the way of devotion. It is devotion to a deity. It's worked out in acts of devotion, worship, both public and private, to a particular deity. You get to choose the deity that you want to be devoted to. And this devotion to a deity is based upon love for the deity, and it's carried out in human relationships of love for family, love for your master, love in all relationships. And this kind of devotion can lead one to ultimate salvation. As I mentioned, the Bhagavad Gita is the work which has devoted special attention to this way of salvation. And the fourth way is the way of yoga. From Buddhism, we learn that yoga means a yoking. And the goal of Hindu meditation is to yoke the Atman, your personal consciousness, with the Brahman, the universal consciousness. And they have several different forms of yoga that you can use. One yoga has specifically to do with ethics, another with devotion, another with meditation, another with wisdom or enlightenment. In other words, the first three steps that we talked about, there's a form of meditation or yoga that's devoted to those steps. So instead of doing those things, if you want to just think about them, you can go this fourth way. Perhaps you've seen pictures of Muslim holy men sitting up in trees or something emaciated and just sitting there doing their yoga. They're practicing the way of yoga to try to reach nirvana. There are three essential deities as objects of devotion in Hinduism. Remember, Brahmin is the absolute ultimate reality. It is manifested in three lesser gods. They are Brahma, the Creator, God, Creator of life and the entire universe. He's usually depicted with four heads, one looking in all four directions. Vishnu is the protector and preserver who guides the cycle of birth and rebirth. And Shiva is the destroyer, but also the recreator, the source of good and evil, but also is depicted as the destroyer of evil. And Shiva is often depicted with a coiled cobra around his neck. Okay, I want to look at some of these vocabulary terms. Atman, I've talked about, A-T-M-A-N. It's another one of those Hindu words that's kind of difficult to define. It means the soul or the true self, the part of each living thing that is eternal. And Maya is another term that you use in Hinduism quite a bit, M-A-Y-A. Remember, we ran into that in Buddhism, meaning illusion. The word is often translated as illusion, but it's kind of misleading as far as Hindu thinking is concerned. You would think that with the world being an illusion, that the world need not be taken seriously, but that is not the Hindu understanding. Hindus believe that as long as the world appears real, and it demands to us to act as if it is real, and it's kind of a qualified reality on a provisional level. And they liken it to a dream. Now, if you have a dream, can you say that your dream is real? Well, you can give a qualified yes to that. I mean, you did have the dream, but what you dreamed about doesn't necessarily reflect what's in reality. You may have dreamed something that has not happened or about people you don't think exist, or you just can't say that what you dreamed is reality. And that's kind of the way that the Hindus look at the reality that we see. You know, they see a dream as a psychological construct, and they believe that what we see in the world is also a psychological construct. You know, given the human mind in its normal condition, the world appears as we see it. But we have no right to infer from this that reality is in itself the way it appears. In other words, we can't believe what we see. A child seeing a motion picture will see the images up on the screen and he won't know they're not real because they look real. They look like they reflect things that he's seen off the screen. But it's not reality. It just looks like reality. Then we have the word karma. Karma literally means action and has reference to a person's actions and the consequences thereof. And as we've said, one's present state of existence in Hinduism is determined by his performance in previous lifetimes. The law of karma is the law of moral consequence. So every action has a consequence to it. The goal of Hinduism is to achieve enough good karma to remove yourself from the cycle of rebirths and achieve this state of eternal bliss. Another word that's not on your list is samsara, S-A-M-S-A-R-A. That's the Hindu word for the transmigration of the soul, or what we call reincarnation. They believe that this continuous chain of rebirths consists of sufferings from results of acts of ignorance or sins in past lives. During each successive rebirth, the soul moves from one body to another and carries with it the karma from the previous life. The rebirth may be into a higher form, higher caste, or if you're an animal, into a human being, or it could be into a lower form. And they believe that this wheel of karma, the law of karma, applies to both man and animals. Accordingly, all creatures, both man and beast, are in their current situations because of the actions or the karma of previous life. A couple of other things I want to just maybe of interest to you. You've seen the Hindu women going around with the little colorful dots between their eyebrows on their forehead. There's a meaning behind that. It's called a bindi, B-I-N-D-I. Like Buddhism, women in Hinduism are hardly, if ever, allowed to be in the priestly caste. Your best bet, if you're a Buddhist or a Hindu, if you're a woman, is to be reborn as a man. Because the Hindu goal is an inner kind of mental consciousness of your oneness with the universe, it requires a supramental consciousness in search of the truth of the divine within you. And women are given a little extra help by means of this mystic third eye that goes on their forehead. Through that, they're able to see the truth better. Or so they say. And one other thing that might be of interest to you are those holy cows. Now, why do Hindus reverence the cow so much? Well, they regard all living creatures as sacred. And from the time that the Aryans entered India, the cow has symbolically represented all creatures on earth. It's the living symbol of Mother Earth. Therefore, the cow is particularly sacred, and feeding a cow is considered an act of worship. The cow represents life and the sustenance of life. It represents our souls, our obstinate intellect, our unruly emotions. But the cow exceeds human beings because it is also giving. Taking nothing but the grass and the grain that the earth provides, the cow just gives, gives and gives and gives. It selfishly gives of itself to others. During certain times of the year, the cows receive the same honor as other gods do. They are anointed with oils, expensive oils, garlands are placed around their necks. Farmers who release cows to wander in the street are given special devotion, special honor. And they are thought to remove bad karma if you let your cow loose. When the cow is running free, the milk and any other byproducts that come off the cow are free to everyone who wants them. Dung is another one of the byproducts of a cow that's in much demand in India. In the poorer sections, dung is used as medicine, disinfectant, fuel for fires, and countless other uses. So the cow is vital to life, the virtual sustainer of life for humans. The cow is a complete ecology, a gentle creature, and a symbol of abundance. The two most grievous sins in Hinduism is to kill a Brahmin, a priestly caste, or to kill a cow. That's how sacred they consider the cows. Now, if we look at the religious dimensions of the Hindu worldview, in the experimental dimension, the Bhagavad Gita really gives a bird picture of what nirvana should be like. When this main character, Arunja, experienced the Lord Krishna, he had what we've been calling the numinous experience. It was such a holy or majestic kind of experience for him. It's almost like he had his own personal nuclear explosion within him. Just experiencing Lord Krishna was such a magnanimous event for him. And that's what they expect it to be like when you reach nirvana. Another experiential part of their religion is the yoga. The emptiness of the mind, the stillness of feelings, the perfect quietness is something that you can experience. And of course, the ultimate experience is the oneness with the Brahman, reaching nirvana. Kind of like enlightenment with Buddhism, I have never seen anybody or talked with anybody that has actually experienced that. They talk about it, but either it's something you don't live through or it's just not realistic. In the mythic dimension, of course, the Vedas, the Upanishads, the Bhagavad Gitas, they all contain these epic mythic stories about heroes and gods. And these become the basis for Hindu philosophy and religion. In the doctrinal dimension, the Vedas contain the Hindu doctrinal teachings about the cosmos, how the gods recreate the cosmos from time to time. And the ethical dimension, of course, the ethics is pretty much based on the law of karma. The moral law, or dharma, is not so much a command by God as it is a part of the natural order of things. It's part of the fabric of the cosmos. And to follow it is to follow the natural bent of things. Thus, the caste system is just a natural part of the being of the world, and you just go with it. And if you try to go against the caste system, then it's sin. Now, outside of the caste system, there's what's called the untouchables. Now, those are the people with leprosy, HIV, AIDS, and the people who do not live within the caste system. If you violate the caste system, you just cast out. You're literally cast out. You become an untouchable. Nobody wants to have anything to do with you. About 20 years ago, the Indian government outlawed treating anybody as an outcast or identifying somebody as an outcast. But you can pass a law, but you still can't stop people from despising other people or from avoiding other people. So being an outcast is still pretty much a part of Hindu society today. You might remember Mother Teresa. Those are the ones that she had the heart for. In the ritual dimension, ritual impurity can be cleansed by a bath in the Ganges River. Or in extreme cases, like if you killed a Brahmin priest or a cow, there's an atonement ceremony that's carried out by a council of Brahmins. Of course, Hindus have temples all over the place. They have millions of gods, and you can build a temple to any god you want to, so there's plenty of temples around India. Temple worship is pretty much like Buddhism. The temples are a miniature reconstruction of the universe. And one of the main rituals that they perform is going inside the temple and marching in a clockwise direction around the temple to simulate the sun's moving toward an eternal end to everything. The priests are there. The priests can teach you. They can teach you from the Vedas. The temples have statues in them of these gods. The gods are not always home, so the priest can summon the god to come back into the statue if you want to worship him. They do sacrifices of fruits and flowers and incense. And, of course, like most religions, the Hindus have pilgrimages and festivals. And they have the rites of passages ceremonies for births, marriages, deaths, like most religions. And in the social dimension, Hinduism has a profound effect on Indian society. Like I said, Hinduism is not a religious word. It kind of describes India and the society of India. And the caste system defines who your social group is. Now, looking at the points of contact with Christianity, who is God? Hinduism's supreme being is the undefiable, impersonal Brahman, that philosophical absolute. And besides him, a vast plurality of gods and goddesses exist as part of this impersonal Brahman. Of course, Christianity, on the other hand, believes in one supreme God. He's an infinite personal creator. He's loving and keenly interested in the affairs of mankind, quite in contrast to the deities of Hinduism, which are quite aloof. As far as man is concerned, Hindus view man as a manifestation of the impersonal Brahman, without individual self or self-worth or purpose. In other words, Hinduism doesn't teach a purpose for us being here, or even a value for us being here, which is quite different from Christianity, that teaches that man was made in the image of God with a personality and the ability to receive and give love of ultimate value to God, infinite value to God, so valuable that God gave his son to die for man. As far as sin is concerned, in Hinduism, there is no sin against a holy God. Acts of wrongdoing are not done against any God, but against oneself, and are mainly a result of ignorance. Now, these evils can be overcome by following the guidelines of one's caste and a way of salvation. Of course, Christianity sees a different, sees sin as an act of rebellion against a perfect and holy God. All acts of sin are ultimately acts of rebellion against the laws of God. As far as the penalty of sin is concerned, in Hinduism, since sin is committed only against oneself, the penalties are accrued only against oneself. And the penalty is in the form of a demerit against one's karma, with the consequence of another cycle of reincarnation to a higher or a lower position, depending on how you are in your karma account. In Christianity, sin has a different purpose, or not a purpose, it has a different effect. Sin cannot exist in the presence of God. Therefore, the penalty of sin is spiritual separation from God. And if salvation is not obtained, this separation will be for all eternity in a place of torment called hell. And salvation in Hinduism is the release from the wheel of life, the cycles of rebirth through which we must work to better ourselves. And it has to be worked out by each individual through successive lives. Salvation in Hinduism can be attained in one of those four ways that I talked about. In Christianity, salvation is from a potentially eternal separation from God and cannot be obtained by any good deeds, but rather is freely given by God to all who will receive it. It's a free gift from God which must be accepted and not achieved. Jesus bought our salvation by taking all of our sins upon himself, dying on the cross as a sacrifice in our place, and then rising from the dead 3 days later. Salvation begins the moment we accept Jesus as our Lord and Savior and continues forever, even after death. The idea of karma leaves no room for forgiveness or grace. There's no being out there who can or will forgive. Thus, a person must pay for any wrong actions he commits. No one else can do it for him. Now, that's one thing that you can talk to a Hindu about. Now, whatever actions he does, he bears the consequences. But, praise the Lord, in Christianity, we don't. We have forgiveness. There is grace, and that's something that a Hindu wishes that he had. As far as the view of the cosmos, Hinduism views the material world as a transitory manifestation of Brahman and of secondary importance to the realization of the absolute Brahman. Christianity sees the world as having object reality, and its source is the creative will of God. And Jesus Christ. Most Hindus accept the fact that Jesus lived, and they usually view him as a great guru who taught the truth about the absolute Brahman. Some teach that Jesus was an avatar, an incarnation of the god Vishnu. And most Hindus would believe that if a person lived a moral Christian life conforming to the teachings of Jesus, that they would have a real good chance of being reborn as a Hindu. And therefore would be a step closer to release from the cycle of reincarnation. And that's basically what Hinduism is all about. I'll call your attention to the discussions questions. I have a unique question on here about somebody that's on a long train journey. But if you have time, I'll call your attention to question number 3. How might Paul's address to the Areopagus in Acts 17 be used to witness to a Hindu? You remember there, Paul had run around the city and he saw all the statues and he saw one to an unknown god. And from that, he brought a message. So if you put on your thinking caps, maybe you can get a message to a Hindu out of that. Well, thank you for your attention. You may have your discussions.